Well, I promised a night of breakthroughs and firsts. So we'll see whether or not our original prediction in the first hour comes true about the Chicago Bulls winning it all and whether or not there will be some fix in Brian Toohey's book, The Fix Is In. He's making that prediction based on what he has gathered over the years about the NBA, plus something which he was told, which he's putting together as two and two and coming up with that. We'll see whether or not that turns out to be correct in the weeks ahead. Also, the book from Robert Merritt, you can link up to that at coasttocoastam.com. But we really are, I mean, with all of the discussion about the weather and all of the unique circumstances going on in the world, or some people are really focused on the fact that there is less than a month to go before the end of the world as we know it on May 21st. So David Elkington was on a couple of weeks ago, and he was just revealing the information that was in the Jordan codices, these metal books which have an unusual history, but very likely go back very far, if not all the way back to the first century, as David Elkington, Egyptologist and a researcher into biblical archaeology, told us a little while ago. So let's get the latest. He said he would come back on as soon as he could and tell us what he could, and we'll do that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, David Elkington, thanks for giving us a whole show tonight. I know I'm looking forward to phone calls coming in for you later on this evening, and I know that you've been busy since we last spoke, so why don't you bring us up to date on your travels since the last time we were on Coast to Coast.
Hi, Ian. It's good to speak with you. Yes, I've just come back from Jordan with my wife, Jennifer, and we've been busy actually getting the site of the codices secure, and it's now under military protection. And we've spoken with the head of the Department of Antiquities to go through with him what we think the codices are, exactly the circumstances of where they were found. And we've taken them to the site, them being the entire team of the Department of Antiquities. And we were quite taken aback by their response. They were really, really quite amazed at the site and the fact that it is so huge and so riddled with so many caves. And in fact, you know, having spent a long time up there, we still have only really penetrated, I'd say, a third of the valley.
So I know. When you say the site, just so I understand, you're talking about the site of where the codices were originally discovered in Jordan?
That's right. That's right. There's a lot of archaeological sites in the Middle East. I mean, it's impossible almost to actually secure everything. But this is a particularly important place because as soon as you enter the tomb site, as it were, you go down into a valley. And then you think, well, the valley's going to end at some stage or other, but it actually just gets deeper and deeper and deeper. It becomes a kind of a chasm as the cliffs rise up hundreds of feet above you. And, of course, riddled in those cliffs are all sorts of caves and other areas which all have to be investigated. And we have, in the past few weeks, found a couple of sealed caves that have yet to be entered into. So we suspect that there will be other artifacts to be discovered in the next few months or so.
All right. Well, we last left this off with you, though. You were still in the process of trying to get these metal books, these codices. You were still trying to get them repatriated to Jordan. Have they been repatriated?
We've had 10 of them repatriated, and there are negotiations ongoing at the present time as we speak to see if we can get them, the rest of them, back from Israel, and we'll have more news on that over the next sort of month or so. But at the same time, we wanted to actually see if there was still anything left at the cave site, and that's why we went back to work with the Department of Antiquities to see if we could uncover any more artifacts from the site, and not just artifacts, but also other evidence from the site. Sure. That can help us to date them and to tell us about the community that wrote them.
And so when you say The Department of Antiquities, you mean the Jordanian Department of Antiquities?
Exactly, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Right, because that's important, because the Israeli Department of Antiquities, that's a very powerful organization, and they allowed then these codices, or at least 10 of them, to be returned to Jordan.
We're in discussions with them at the present time to actually see if we can get the Israeli books repatriated to Jordan. But the other 10 books that have appeared in the past few weeks have either been handed in by members of the public over in Jordan, or they've actually been seized. And, of course, we're now just in the process of investigating those and checking them out in terms of authenticity. So we have more experimentation undergoing at the moment. I'm about to go to a major British university to ask them to help out and see if we can get tests done, etc. So there's a lot of news. There's a lot of things happening. And as I say, having the Jordanians having seen these things for themselves, I mean, I have to point out here that in Jordan, there is a university in the North Country called Yarmouk University. And having spoken with a lot of the world's most eminent biblical scholars, every single one of them, without exception, has said that Yarmouk University is the place to go. It has the world's greatest reputation for biblical scholarship, for epigraphy and paleography, which is the understanding of ancient writing. And so, of course, Yarmouk is not that far away from our cave site in Jordan. So at the same time as going to the cave site, the same evening, we went to Yarmouk University in order to make links with them to see if they can help. And in fact, they are now very, very much on board, and we will be working with them very, very closely over the next few years or so to determine further what these things are, what they say, and sure, the context in which they were discovered.
All right. Now, again, we're going to go forward here with new information in just a moment, but I want to go back again to make sure I understand. So when you were originally on Coast to Coast, we were talking about these books that were by and large metal books, but some were not, and they were bound with leather straps, and there was already tests being done, such as that was, on what you had that was available. And those were all in Israel. They were all in the collection of a guy who had said that he had inherited them originally, whereas another version of the story was that they had been found by a Jordanian Bedouin and transferred to an Israeli Bedouin, and that's how they ended up in Jerusalem. Do I got that right so far?
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on.
Okay. Yeah. All right, but all of those codices, those are still in Israel. And what you're referring to then are some new metal books similar to the ones that had already been found that were now found since we last talked in Jordan?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And very exciting, too, because they're very some of the books are quite large. Obviously, some of them are average size compared to the ones that are over in Israel. And as I say, we're just investigating those at the moment.
Okay. And these were the Jordanian government put out a call and said, look, we're looking for these. If you've got them, bring them forward.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now
we're up to speed, I think.
A few weeks ago. And in the light of the press conference, members of the public came forward to say, well, actually, we've got some of these. We've recognized them. Here they are. The Jordanian public know full well that anything found at Jordanian archaeological sites actually belongs to the government or the Kingdom of Jordan, and that therefore they're very, very important to the country itself in terms of, you know, putting these things in a museum and getting people, tourists and co to come and visit. So, you know, in a sense, what it's shown so far is that the site still has an awful lot to give up in terms of its secrets. But
sure,
furthermore, what it shows is that the Israeli Bedouin story that they've been in his family for generations is simply not true. And of course, We have a saying over here about people who tell such untruths. We say, "Well, he would say that, wouldn't he?" What we mean by that is that I can't blame him for telling that story, but I'm afraid to say he's looking a bit sort of, shall we say, uncomfortable at the moment, knowing full well that the site has been exposed, as has his presence at it.
Right. Okay. So I get that. So here we go. I'm gonna ask you a couple more questions about these new codices then, and explain for people that aren't up to speed yet on this, what language they're written in and what makes these unique. Why do you think these books predate, in many cases, the books of what the Christians would call New Testament?
That's a very good question, and one which I'll now reveal a bit more, which I haven't revealed before. First of all, the books are all made of lead, including the binding rings, and they are written in a dialect of Hebrew called Hasmonean Hebrew, which dates back to the first century BC. This language was not used after the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, why do I think they're Christian? Well, first of all, they bear all the hallmarks of the coming Messiah. We actually have letters that imply the coming of the Messiah. The letter Tav, or T, as we would call it, is actually represented in Hasmonean Hebrew as an X-type cross. And we know that when the early Christians of the first century baptized their converts, they always did so with the sign of the cross or the X above their heads. Second to that, we've got palm trees that are in fruit. Now, the palm tree is indicative of the house of David. Therefore, the fact that it is in fruit says that there is a seed of the house of David. And beneath the palm trees, we have a series of eight-pointed stars, which are generally symbolic of the spirit of God or of Melchizedek. And this is a sign of the coming of the high priestly Messiah. But more than this, the central codex that was found amongst the discovery contains a series of portraits, and the portrait on the front cover is that of Christ, and it shows him as the suffering servant Messiah who was predicted by Isaiah, the prophet, back in the 800s BC to make his appearance on earth as the Son of God. So what we have on this front cover is we have inside a halo a picture of the bearded Christ. And obviously we have other pictures of him on the interior as well. But what's fascinating about the portrait itself is that you cannot mistake it for anybody else. It is definitely him. If you compare it to what we know of early portraits of Christ, it is literally impossible to come to any other conclusion. The fact that the portrait itself is haloed or cartouched means that it is showing him as a divine person who has achieved the status of having walked into the temple and walked out again. And this is almost the single reason why I say that these are definitely early Christian documents.
Okay, very interesting. Now, the Jordanian response to this has been to give, you know, to tell the Israeli antiquities, we want these other ones back. Give us these other codices that these are ours. These were discovered here. We want them back. How's that coming along?
There are high-level discussions going on as we speak. It seems to be very positive. And as I say, I can't say much more than that, but I expect there will be news over the next month or
so. All right. Now, in the material that's in the ones that we have already seen, and we put a link up on our website at coasttocoastam.com. If you go down, you can link up to this and you can see the pictures here of these metal codices that we're referring to. There was information that you alluded to that you thought was transformative. It would change the world, that it had the possibility of uniting the world. Is that still your belief after having looked at this more? And is this similar to the information that's in the Jordanian codices?
It's very similar, and it is still my belief. In fact, the belief is now much stronger as a result of having looked at these things in greater depth, because when you see the face of Christ and you see what is on the front of the codices, you put two and two together. There's an awful lot that comes out of it in terms of the episode of the resurrection and what Christ truly represented. Now, I would suggest in my interpretation that there is a very subtle difference with what perhaps mainstream Christianity would have us believe. But however, it doesn't take away from what Christianity truly is. And if anything, it confirms the underlying story in the Gospels and confirms for the first time that Christ not only existed, but he was truly a king of Israel. And that's a very fascinating thing indeed. In terms of its ability to unite the world, obviously what we've got here is the story of Christianity emerging from its older religion of Hebrewism. And obviously, when we look at some of the books, we see some very ancient symbols indeed. And that's perhaps very surprising, because you would expect for Christianity to be a completely new movement within the first century. But that's not what we get here. What we've got here of very ancient symbols. I'll give you one example, the menorah, or the Jewish candlestick, as it's famously known as today. This is something that was forbidden from representation in its day. Some scholars have disputed my statement of that, but we've since come back with the various quotes from the Talmud, which prove that point. The seven-branch candlestick, it was actually indicative of the presence of wisdom in the temple. And as you know from the Gospels and from other Christian writings from the early period, Jesus was sometimes referred to as the Son of Wisdom. So what we have here is, in a sense, you've got old temple symbols that are being restored, old symbols that have not actually been seen in Hebrewism for a very long time, because during the centuries of 600 BC right up to the 2nd century BC, the old religion was reformed. It was rewritten. It was rebalanced, as it were, and it was totally unrecognizable from what it originally was. And when you look at the codices, what you end up concluding is that Jesus was actually seeking to restore some of these things to his belief system, to the existing belief system, and then, you know, he went on from there. We have the creation of the Christian church, because, of course, we know that after the fall of Jerusalem, you have the rise of Christianity, and about 200 years later, you have the rise of rabbinic Judaism. So, of course, you've got this split that occurs. And I suspect that the split occurred simply because of this need or this want to restore these lost symbols, these lost episodes from the early Hebrew Bible. And that in itself is fascinating, because if we could actually piece together the story of that restoration, our understanding of the early Hebrew period, let alone the early Christian period, will simply become complete.
Okay. Now, to make sure I understand you, when you said there's a subtle difference between what mainstream Christianity would say and what these codices are indicating, do I understand you right that that subtle difference is just an interpretation of these symbols? Or was there a greater point that I lost here when you said there's a subtle difference between what modern mainstream Christianity believes and what the codices say?
There is a subtle difference. And the thing is that before you go any further, what is necessary to understand about the codices and what is necessary to understand about what they're saying about this early period is something that you don't see that often in the Gospels. It's mentioned a couple of times, and then suddenly it disappears. And what I'm talking about here is the role of the temple. The Temple of Jerusalem was the deep, throbbing heart of Judaism, of Hebrewism at the time. Inside the Temple of Jerusalem inside the holy place, the secret place itself, was said to reside the spirit of the Lord God himself. So, of course, what you have here is an organic, living, beating heart deep inside Jerusalem. Now, if you go to the Gospels, Jesus performs various of his miracles, and it kind of builds up to the episode when he goes into the temple. But then he throws out the money changers, and you hear nothing more after that. He then goes on to the Garden of Gethsemane, where, of course, he's arrested.
And that's just let's pick that up there, right there, coming up then next. And I'd love to be able to, with you, David Elkington, also run by some of the other things that have been said against these codices and have you answer to that next on Coast to Coast. We're talking with David Elkington, Egyptologist and an investigator into these Jordanian codices, as they're so called. Go take a look at the photos. We put them up at coasttocoastam.com. Just click on to the story there in the description of tonight's show. And we'll pick it up where David was explaining the subtle differences between how we're to understand what the codices seem to be telling us and what we thought we knew about what Christians called the New Testament. But I also want to have David respond to some criticism that's been offered by other people who say that these are flat-out forgeries. And they give some examples of why they say these metal codices, these books, which David Elkington says clearly go back to the first century, are in fact not valid. And I'd love to hear what he has to say to them in response coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Well, David Elkington was on with us when the original story broke across the wires about the discovery here of these metal books, codexes, as they're called, or codices. And the Jordanian codices, highly disputed between both Israel and Jordan, but also between scholars. But before we get back to that, I just want you to go back to what you were saying, the sort of the nuanced difference between what the metal books indicate and what the mainstream Christianity says.
It's very interesting. As I said, you know, the story of Christ ends at Gethsemane. You know, he's then arrested for a reason that isn't really specified and crucified. But, of course, the temple plays a very minor role in the Gospels. But it's almost as if when you read the Gospels, they're kind of heading towards the temple, and then at the last minute they kind of take a diversion. And you have to ask yourself why. And when you look at the codices and you look at their representations of the temple, you know, particularly with God living inside it, you see that actually the temple must have been central not only to the Jews and the Hebrews of the day, but also to the first Christians. Because, of course, if God lived there, then, of course, it would make sense that Jesus didn't just go in to rid the temple of the money changers, but that he actually went inside as well to meet God and to kind of, you know, meet his Father, as it were. So, of course, there's a very subtle difference there in the sense that for the first time, we seem to have confirmation that the temple was very, very much at the center of Christianity when it was founded. And that's a very important point.
And then, in fact, until the burning of the temple some 40 years after the crucifixion, we don't know how much time early Christians spent at the temple.
We don't. That's quite right. You know, we only have the Gospels to go by. And now, of course, we have the Jordan Codices, which is fantastic. But obviously, it's early days yet. We've got more work to do on the translation and transcription. We've got more work to do on the authentication, etc. And as I say, you know, in years to come, we should know a lot more.
All right. So let me just say, you're amongst friends here for this conversation. However, I would be remiss if I didn't have you address some of the ongoing criticism of the Jordan Codices by either scholars that have appeared on Coast to Coast or who have been writing about it, some of which indicate that you yourself had about a year ago or so, you had a previous discovery, which these critics are using as a way of sort of knocking you down at the knees a little bit by saying that a year ago you said you had something and this is very much the same thing. Can you explain that?
Thank you for mentioning this, because I did want to bring this up. What's really curious about the people who have criticized this thing is that as yet, neither I nor my team of very eminent biblical scholars, some of the most eminent in the field, have yet released any analysis of the books. We haven't yet released any of the meta reports. We've had four analyses performed, which have said that the codices are consistent with a first century date. But we haven't yet announced that because these things belong to Jordan, and it's up to the Kingdom of Jordan to decide when they want to actually publish that analysis. Obviously, we've undertaken that ourselves in order to bring it to their attention. But, you know, we're dealing here with another country's artifacts. We just can't walk in and take over. That wouldn't be right. And it, frankly, at the beginning of the day, it would just be sheer bad manners. And I simply don't want to go down that pathway. But second to that, as a part of this project, I was sent some photographs by the Israeli Bedouin at the beginning of last year. Now, it showed bronze or copper codices, and I'd never seen any of those. The only ones in the collection that I've had my hands on are actually lead. So seeing what looked like a Greek inscription on one of them, I went to an Oxford academic whom I was told I could rely on and who would keep the matter confidential. And I gave him a very tiny photograph of one of these copper codexes and asked him to actually see if he could make any sense of the inscription. He came back to me after having swapped a couple of emails, which he agreed to keep in confidence. And he said, actually, he couldn't make head or tail of the inscription. To his mind, he would bet his career that it was a forgery. And we thought, oh, that's very interesting, because, of course, it's a well-known thing with Bedouin that when they discover a cache of either documents or artifacts, they will generally fill it out further with their own forgeries in order to obviously make more money from it in the long run. So we kind of dismissed the things there and then because we hadn't seen them, we hadn't tested them, and the only way we could actually assess them was through this inscription. So you can imagine my astonishment when a few weeks ago, this same academic who had agreed to keep the matter in confidence, who had agreed to work with the team, who had agreed that it would stay private, actually went to all and sundry and said that not only are the copper codexes fakes, but the entire hoard are just a collection of forgeries. Now, on the basis of one tiny, a rather small photograph of low resolution, he has decided to dismiss the entire thing. That would be like going into Tutankhamun's tomb and saying that one of the statues is a fake and therefore saying that the entire find is completely forged. It simply doesn't make sense. His assessment goes against the overall scientific assessment of the books that we've had performed so far, which has been both chemical, spectrographic, crystallographic, and corrosion. And every single one of those tests so far has said that the lead is consistent with a first century date. Therefore, when you look at the surface of these documents and you see that the letters themselves have been molded, they've been not engraved on the surface, but they've actually been molded with the lead, and that the lettering too is corroded and very, very worn and old, you'll see that therefore these things are on the whole very, very consistent with that same first century dating. And so far, none of the academics who have criticized the find have answered that question. If they are forgeries, how did the Bedouin actually achieve the corrosion of lead on a basis that makes it consistent, not only with a 2,000-year-old date, but apparently, according to a lot of the world scientists, it's very, very difficult and extremely expensive to corrode lead falsely. And furthermore, we have here a language, Hasmonean Hebrew, of which only three or four experts in the world speak. Therefore, when we look at the symbolism, the iconography, the language, the state of the metal, you put all of that together, what you've got here is a real genius, somebody who is such a master of their art that, in fact, if we could find him and we can show that these things are forgeries, then fine. I think he should be given a doctorate and a professorship at one of the world's top universities, because it means that this man is a scholar on a par with the very best in our team, if not better. Because the problem is with these things is that in order to forge them, you would have to have all the latest up-to-date information. And I think that that is simply impossible.
All right. Now, is it true that there are some Greek phrases that are embossed in these codices?
There are no Greek phrases at all on the lead codices. That we have so far discovered only one language, Hasmonean Hebrew, and there are signs of no other language at all.
Well, because one of the critiques that I read said specifically that there is the Greek that appears at the top of, and I'm reading from a website here, I guess it's Peter Thuneman. Am I pronouncing that right?
Thuneman? That's the chap that we took the initial photograph to, who I've just described, at Oxford University. He is the man who has actually made this rather bizarre claim that the entire find is a hoax on the basis of a photograph I was sent last year by the Bedouin of a book with a Greek inscription on it, which I have never physically had contact with.
Okay.
And Dr. Toneman knows that. So I'm afraid to say that we have more analysis to perform, of course, and we have to be very cautious, naturally. But the only reason that we announced the discovery of the Jordan codices in the first place is because all of the analysis that has so far been undertaken has shown these things to be consistent with the first century date. You know, in terms of the copper tablet that Dr. Toneman looked at, it may well be a forgery. The next question we have to ask is, first of all, let's get hold of it, let's do some testing, and let's see when it was forged, because it does beg the question, is it a medieval forgery? And we know an awful lot of things were forged in the medieval period. Or was it something that was created in modern times? Unfortunately, I can't answer that question because I haven't seen the thing with my own eyes.
Okay.
I suspect that when I do, the differences will be very, very telling indeed.
Because he said that... that after you showed him these photographs, he could tell that it was Greek and bad Greek. On top of that, he said the text showed a codices with a metal cover where the Greek inscription reads here, without grief, farewell. Abgar, also known as Ison or Ession. And he says that this text corresponds to a Greek text of a bilingual Aramaic Greek inscription published in 1958, inscriptions that he said that in its entirety indicates that somebody was just copying something without knowing its meaning, and they were doing that just because it just looked like it gave it some authenticity. What's your thought on that?
Well, that may well be the case. As I say, you have to be very careful when dealing with Bedouin because, as I say, they find something, their general way of making more money from that find is to actually make artifacts that are very similar to it and then to sell those on the open market. And they generally sell the real McCoy, the real artifact, very late on in the day. It's a well-known trend, and it happens throughout the Middle East. The fact of the matter is, though, is that that's the reason why my team and I decided that we would have to analyze chemically and spectrographically the lead of the lead codices before we go any further. And as you can see, once we had actually performed four separate analyses of these codices, we then engaged our academic team, and the general consensus is that they are, in fact, original.
Okay. He said that there's not even enough rust on these codices for as old as these books would be, that there would be more rust. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I have to correct the gentleman concerned there, because lead does not rust. It corrodes in a different way entirely. Second to that, He is not a biblical scholar. He is a Greek classicist. He does not speak Hebrew and therefore could not make sense of the language on the lead codices. Further to that, he is not an expert in the makeup or the chemical constituents of metals. What we have to do there is we have to take these things to very highly qualified metallurgists. And they have again shown that these things are totally consistent with the first century dating. I'm afraid to say that Dr. Toneman's analysis should have stayed within the bounds of his teaching as a classicist. He's gone way beyond his responsibilities in saying what this is, in saying that it's a forgery, because, as I say, it was on the basis of one tiny low-resolution photograph, and I'm afraid to say that he's quite wrong to dismiss the lead codices as being forgeries and to totally go against the analyses that were undertaken at some of the world's major universities. And I'm afraid to say that this is very irresponsible scholarship, and this is where things can generally sometimes get very confused for your general readership or audience, because they sometimes wonder, well, who can we believe?
Right.
And the problem here is that, you know, I was fully aware when we first discovered these things of what they were. It was very interesting, you know, but of course, before I could go any further, we had to, at great expense and in terms of time and money and our efforts there, we had to make sure that these things were authentic. And the best way of doing that was to test the metal itself. And so we took a few trimmings from one of the books that was sent off to two universities, one in the UK, one in Europe, and they both came back independent of each other with the same results, that basically it was consistent with Roman lead from the first century, both in terms of chemical makeup, but also in terms of the corrosion of these things,
sure.
Which, you know, if it was metal, if it was steel or iron, of course it would rust. But lead does not rust. It is an extraordinary substance. And for there to be an impurity breakthrough on the surface of the lead is extremely rare. What we have, if you look at it microscopically on the surface, is you've actually got a chemical reaction taking place where the impurities in the lead have begun to break through like pustules, like spots on the surface of a teenager's face. And they've begun to erode the surface of the metal by chemical reaction. Now, when we asked an expert on this, he said, well, this is really quite extraordinary. He said, I've never seen lead in a fragile state like this. He said, this is consistent with an age of 1800 to 2000 years. That for us was the clincher. And it was from that moment onwards that we decided then we could start looking at the language, iconography, and everything else.
All right. Well, we'll put that to rest for now, but people may have more questions about that coming up later on. On Coast to Coast, we're talking with David Elkington about the metal codices, the Jordanian codices, as they're called. And there have been more that have been added to the collection since his last appearance on Coast to Coast, this coming from the Jordanian government. And we talked a little bit about content. How much more would you be willing to reveal about what is in any of these metal codices?
A bit, yeah, for sure. There's a bit we can talk about, for sure. But of course, at the end of the day, before we can discuss that, what we need to do to understand is actually the ground upon which these things are built. Because once you have an understanding of that, then you can understand what is written inside them. And
explain
that's why
the...
earlier on I mentioned the idea of the temple being right. The center of Christianity.
Okay, that's all right. So the ground you're talking about, the foundation you're talking about, is this understanding that according to the codices, the role of the temple was much more prominent in the life of the intertestamental period, the late period of the Old Testament writings and the early period of Christianity.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, and so with that as just kind of a teaser here, and we'll just remind people then that the temple is more important. Give us another glimpse of what's actually in the pages.
Well, what's interesting is that we have here a collection of texts that are repeated throughout a lot of the books, but that they are all centered upon the idea of resurrection. And that is fascinating because, of course, as we know, the resurrection is the central point of Christianity. It's the point at which Christianity orbits. Now, you have to ask yourself, what do they mean by that? And that's a curious thing. If we look at the central face of Christ upon one of the codexes, it is actually one of the most beautiful images I've ever seen. Now, a lot of scholars are wrong-footed by this. They're kind of looking for newness in the codices, whereas really what they should be looking at is the codices and Christianity as a continuation of that which has gone before. And when we look at resurrection, we have a point here in question. Are we here looking at a physical resurrection? Are we looking at a spiritual resurrection or what? And that's something that I'd like to discuss, you know, in the next few minutes.
I'd like to do that. So hang on to that thought and we'll pick it up right there. Perfect breaking point then. What do the codices tell us about a physical versus a spiritual resurrection? And do the codices essentially mirror the story of Mark in the Christian New Testament, the Gospel of Mark, and its unusual original ending? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.